Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another case of Your Cases on Hold. We are in the new year now, so welcome back from your holiday season. Hopefully you got some Yuletide going on or some family and friends time, and you were able to enjoy it. So thank you for starting your new year with us. I'm Antonia Chen, Deputy Editor of Adult Reconstruction, and I have here...
I am Andrew Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor for Methods, because we had to did it on them. Hopefully everyone caught our New Year's countdown special. I think the confetti is still on your shoulder. Just kidding. There was no New Year's special. I don't want anyone to go looking in the backlogs being like, where was their countdown? I missed it. We did the top 10 articles in 2022 or something like that. That would have been fun if we thought to do that. But I'm only thinking of doing that now.
2023, we'll do it. So as you're writing your articles, submitting it to JBJS, keep in mind, we'll do the top 10.
Don't promise. Don't make promises like that.
Promises that you'll break. Mm-hmm. Well, then you'll keep us accountable. How about top five? Top five. That sounds a little bit easier.
I don't know. When JBJS came and they were like, you know, we want you to 2022 season one was so successful. We want you to do season two. I was just like, really, you guys can't afford me. But then they backed up the Mack truck with all that cash in it. And it turns out that green, the color green is my muse.
I think so. By green, you mean JBJS like journals. They gave you free JBJS journals.
Yeah, I don't even get free JBJS journals. I'm just kidding. They don't pay us to do this, folks. We bring this to you out of the goodness of our heart and how much fun it is.
We have a good time. There's no doubt about that.
That's right.
As a disclaimer, though, our fun is our fun and it is not the opinions of the editorial board or anyone at JBJS. So our opinions or leave them, but they're there. So we thank you for joining us. This is brought to you by the Miller Review course. Go sign up. If you need to take any of those courses, those are great courses to take that you can do for studying for the orthopedic boards, oral boards, et cetera. Without further ado, we're going to go through our headlines. This time for top of the pile for reconstruction.
January 4th issue, 2023. Here we go.
2023, top of the pile. Dr. Shields talked about adult reconstruction. And then there's the first description of compartment syndrome by Al-Zawahiri. So we're getting some good history here.
I almost selected that one for my headline, but then I figured I don't know how many people want to hear about historical orthopedics. Maybe just me.
Well, it's a good meld of your background, right?
Oh, it is. It's a perfect merging of my two contributing streams.
You have more than two contributing streams, my friend.
Thank you.
We'll start with those two. All right. Dichotomies in Leadership, the Presidential Address to the AOA in June 17th, 2022. This is the AOA Critical Issues by Sebastian Ely. Without further ado, we will go into our headlines. Dr. Schoenfeld, can you please tell us about pre-visit digital messaging? Does it improve patient-reported outcome measure participation prior to the orthopedic ambulatory visit? Results from a double-blind, prospective, randomized controlled trial. By Yadula et al., take it away.
All right. And this does have an infographic for our visual learner friends who want to check that out. As we're all probably aware, patient-reported outcome measures are increasingly important for a variety of reasons. And many of our patients are, frankly, and this is some editorializing, keep in mind, it's a new year, but the takes are still hot, sometimes intentionally. Our patients are, you know, overwhelmed by requests for them to complete all sorts of patient-reported outcome measures electronically before the visit, during the visit, after the visit. The most common complaint I actually get in the office is, do I have to fill this out? I don't want to fill this out. Why are you making me fill this out? Truthfully. So this study is a study of how to study, essentially. It's an academic exercise layered on another academic exercise, which is how do we get patients to complete these more fully or more completely? And so they did a randomized trial where patients who registered received no reminder or no prompt to complete their PROMS pre-visit, where they got a patient portal message then they got an email pre-visit message, and they looked at pre-visit prom completion rates. Secondary outcome measures were time to the pre-visit completion, and basically, you know, they wanted to see how, like, if they did the whole thing, basically. So they had 291 patients, and the pre-visit total completion rates for the assigned proms were highest when they got an email at 52%. And then followed by the MyChart or the electronic medical record message, 49%. And then for those who just didn't get anything, the controls, it was 30%. So a demonstrable difference, a meaningful difference. Their conclusion, the results of this randomized trial, pre-visit messaging appear to be a useful strategy for increasing prom completion rates. And that's definitely a valid conclusion. From a methodologic standpoint, they ticked all the boxes. They did everything that they were supposed to do. It's a well-done randomized trial. At the end of the day, I think what's a little bit more sobering is even with like the emailing prompts, about half the patients actually completed the prompts. So it's still totally not that great. And the difference, while 49 and 52% are certainly significantly different from 30%, I don't think 49% and 52% are that different when you're talking about they got the electronic message through the medical record or they got a personalized email. And I think what, you know, they say pre-visit messaging appears to be a useful strategy for increasing prom completion rates. But you know what's even better? Do you know what is even better?
Sharks with freaking laser beams?
No. Dr. Evil is not making an appearance in this episode. He put our case on hold like 6 months ago. No, what's even better is when the patients are actually invested in completing the proms.
Yeah.
And the answer to these things is not, in my opinion, well, we just have to find a way to continue to prompt them to complete these. If they don't understand why they need to complete them, then they're not going to complete them. And that's why even when you have like the most personalized engaged means of reminding them to complete them, only half of them do it because they're still probably saying like, I don't care that you sent me an email. I don't want to do this. I don't see the value in doing this. And we have done prospective studies where we have needed to obtain proms, as I'm sure you have as well. And the patients are consented. They know what they're getting into at the time that they consent. We contact them. We have research assistants help them if they need help. It's a very personalized and resource-intensive means of data collection. But you know what? For those patients, and this was these studies that we've done have been in challenging patient populations, spinal metastases, epidural abscess, and so forth, we have above a 70-80% completion rate. So the problem here is that this is trying to be done in mass, and it's trying to be done essentially on the cheap. What is like the least resource utilization that you can do to increase completion? So I think it's what's going on hold here is the whole premise. I think the whole premise is flawed. And I understand, of course, that, you know, this is here to stay. I'm not trying to get rid of like these mass proms. I think there's a lot of people who are invested in it from a regulatory standpoint, from a hospital administrative standpoint, from an insurance standpoint. Many, I think it's misguided for the wrong reasons. But again, that's a soapbox. But what you need is patient investment. You need provider investment. And you need a clear rationale as to why they're doing it. And if you can't provide all three of those, let alone any one of those, then yeah, you're probably not ever going to get above the 50% benchmark.
And that's the biggest thing. You're exactly right. And I completely 1,000% agree with you. We've gone through this in our own system as well. We're completing proms for the sake of completing proms. And while there may be some benefit to it, because you can retrospectively look at large groups of people and grab data on them, setting it up in a research environment is wonderful. Not everyone has the resources to do it, their research environment, right? So getting patients invested as to why, I mean, that's the biggest question. Patients are like, why am I doing this? And what's the point? And so now they're like, well, we'll put it on a dashboard so you can see it in your electronic medical record system. Well, that's nice. But if it's there and no one's using it, then it's there. So it is encouraging systems to say, okay, it is worth investing maybe some technology to pushing out these emails or these automated messages 7 days prior to the initiation of their visit to get these prompts, to try to collect these prompts. And it does decrease the clog of when patients come into the clinic. We were giving out iPads, and we still do give out the iPads, but it's a high touch system with COVID, everything like that. That's problematic. So anyway, we try to avoid those sort of things. So you're exactly right. This is just telling you, okay, fine, you can justify it by using an electronic system, email or portal system, but we need more. So to your point, you know, ideally with prompts, we're getting 100, we want to get 100%. All right. We want to see how patients are doing, either pre-surgical or post-surgical, or just doing it well, and see how we can address it to make their patient-reported outcomes better. But we're not there yet. So you're right. Get patient investment here. Hopefully, if there's patients listening to this podcast, do it because it's really good. And hopefully get your surgeon or your care team or whoever provider is taking care of you to make sure that they go through those patient-reported outcomes to better understand where you are and where your needs need to be met. On that note, I'm going to switch to my project. So my article is going to switch, and there are patient-reported outcomes in it. Obviously, a higher completion rate because it's part of a larger prospective randomized controlled trial on mid-flexion anterior-posterior stability of total knee replacement implanted with kinematic alignment, a randomized quantitative radiographic laxity study with posterior stabilized and medial stabilized implants. I think we both win the award for longest titles in these episodes. This is by Scott et al. There is also infographic here too, and you can read this forever because it is permanently free. So as total knee surgeons, total knee arthroplasty surgeons, we know that mid-flexion instability is definitely a problem and it's a concern. So we want to try to reduce the amount of mid-flexion instability. The hardest part is really assessing how to assess mid-flexion instability. Patients say they feel unstable when they're going up and down stairs or walking on uneven surfaces, but do they actually have mid-flexion instability and does that affect their outcome? So this study looked at patients who underwent total knee replacements, and they compared posterior stabilized to a medial stabilized construct. And these were all done in a kinematic alignment format. And by doing it in a kinematic alignment, they ensured that all patients were done the exact same way. This was part of a larger randomized prospective study that had a lot more patients in it. At the end of the day, with two exclusion criteria, they were down to 63 patients. It is a small number, in all honesty. It'd be nice to be able to see more patients. It was stated that they went through two rounds of exclusion criteria, but they only listed one exclusion criteria where they, you know, ideally would have listed more of them. They basically excluded patients who had greater than 2-year follow-up. And I found that kind of interesting because for our studies here at JBJS, implant studies should have a minimum of 2-year follow-up. So it might have been actually interesting to see these greater than 2-year follow-up patients to see what their anterior and posterior instability was, especially at 45 degrees, which they took as mid-flexion instability, and also at 90 degrees. So it would have been interesting to add those patients there because they excluded over 100 patients who would have fallen into this time frame. For clinical evaluation, mid-flexion stability, that they did a good job of doing it through a radiographic measure that was standardized, where a patient went to 45 degrees and 90 degrees of flexion, and they put 150 newtons of force on it, and they could see the actual translation. Because if you do it with different people and different hands, you're not actually going to get a good measurement. But there was a clinical examination. They used a goniometer for range of motion, but the clinical evaluation, was it done by the same person or not? Because as we all know, we can all translate patients differently with anterior posterior stress, both at 45 degrees and 90 degrees. There's a study out of the University of Arkansas where they said when the patient's sitting on a table, you think they're 90 degrees, but the thigh circumference can differentiate whether or not it's truly 90 degrees or if it's actually less than 90 degrees. So making these assessments is really important, but the radiographic analysis was helpful. It was done with kinematic alignment, as said before, but it may be beneficial to see these in different settings of patients. So PS versus medial stabilized in a non-kinematic alignment format. And whether or not kinematic alignment is a factor of this or whether or not it's PS, that is a curiosity that maybe some patients do better if they're PS with mechanical alignment or medial stabilized with kinematic alignment. That's a whole different can of worms to open up. For the results of the study, in 45 degrees of flexion, it demonstrated that the medial stabilized group had significantly less anterior and posterior displacement than the PS group. Now, I found the numbers to be pretty interesting. So for the medial stabilized group, it was approximately 4 millimeters versus 16.5 millimeters in the PS group. 16.5 millimeters is over a centimeter and a half. That is a lot of translation when it comes to 45 degrees. And yet, if you look at the final part, when it comes to the outcomes, their forgotten joint score and the range of motion were statistically the same or similar, right? So even with that much amount of translation in mid-flexion, they had very similar forgotten joint scores, which is a good measure of whether or not patients are going to forget their joints. So they forgot their joints despite this huge amount of translation. At 90 degrees of flexion, this is not considered mid-flexion instability. There was no difference in anterior posterior. And just for the female subjects, so now they're looking for something here, and they then teased out gender, and they found gender that female patients in the medial stabilized group, they had less anterior posterior laxity in 90 degrees of flexion than the PS group, 2 versus 5 millimeters. And this is at 90 degrees. So the authors then say, okay, well, the forgotten joint score and the range of motion were similar between groups. But for the medial stabilized group, the knee society score, pain motion, and function scores were better for the medial stabilized. So the key factor to hit mode here is that, is it due to medial stabilized? This is a correlation, not a causation, right? That is not a causation that you use a medial stabilized implant and you get the knee society scores to be better. It did show that medial stabilized patients had with less anterior posterior laxity had higher outcome scores. It did not actually just say specifically that. They said that, but it does not actually say, okay, these are the patients with low translation or low anterior posterior laxity, and what were their outcome scores? So it would have been interesting to see that for PS or MS, right? If you had PS or medial stabilized, if they had just lower translation, did that correlate with better outcome scores? And that would be able to detect, maybe we should aim for the lower anterior posterior laxity. Again, not causation, but a stronger correlation if you were to look just at those numbers. Because the medial laxity patient, the medial stabilized patients likely had a range of anterior posterior laxity, and whether or not that translated to the same outcomes would be yet to be seen. So there's been more limitations in the study. You know, the list of the limitation being a small number of patients, which 63 is a small number of patients. There was no sample size calculation as part of this. And it would be interesting to compare the CS or cruciate substituting or the deeper dish or ultra congruent ones with medial stabilized instead of posterior stabilized with medial stabilized ones. They mentioned the introduction that there was a recent study done in that PS versus the deep dish one. It'd be interesting to see medial stabilized with ultra congruent as a comparison.
I have to say that you all in the arthroplasty field have like the best names for your outcome scores. We have like the Oswestry Disability Index and the Neck Disability Scale. And you guys have like WHOS and COOS and WHOS Junior and COOS Junior. And the best one is absolutely the Forgotten Joint Score. When I was growing up, there was this store on the Lower East Side that had like the absolute best toys and books. It was called Forbidden Planet. And for some reason, every time I see Forgotten Joint Score, it makes me it just seems like the forgotten joint, the forgotten world, the lost joint. I want like a forbidden joint score.
Ooh, it's like a forbidden fruit.
Yes. The joint is so perfect.
It's forbidden. No one can have it.
I'm just like, you know, looking at this, first off, it might be semantics, but they say like that the 63 patients were randomly selected from the larger randomized prospective trial. But if you have a bunch of inclusion and exclusion criteria, is it really random? Like, I'm not sure that's random if you're saying like, okay, we pulled some people out, but then if they didn't meet our criteria, we threw them out. I don't know. You could have just gone through the thing and gotten all the people that meet the inclusion. I'm not sure. And then it leads me to like this number of 63, where is that really enough sufficient clinical variation with just 63 patients? We're at the first episode of the year and Tony Romo is already here with the like, I don't know. It's kind of...
Is that anesthesia calling? Is that what that is?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, that's up to you if anesthesia is calling or not. Dr. Romo is not sure your case can go today. is it really truly level one though? I know they got it from the data's from a randomized trial, but this is not the randomized trial results. So I think there's some points on here that it's like, it seems like it's a little bit of an oversell and some use of the language. It's a little bit questionable.
So maybe a little bit of hold before you decide to make that switch from PS to MS.
Yeah.
Unless there's a real reason to do so. All right.
Is anything ever just a little bit on hold? It's a little bit on hold, but it's always the same hold.
It's a little bit pregnant. You can be yes or no. No in-betweens.
Right.
All right. Dr. Schoenfeld, please talk to us about the environmental impact of orthopedic surgery, Sella et al.
Yes, this is the Your Case is on Hold featurette. Certainly, this is a essentially a narrative review, a little bit outside the box in terms of what we've selected for our head-to-head, back and forth, octagon of lexicon engagement. But you know, really interesting, really timely, and definitely wanted to highlight this for something for the readership to take a look at. There are some things I'm going to put on hold, but we're not putting it on hold from a methodologic standpoint. So I'll get to the points and cover sort of the big picture, and then touch on the things that I think it's like, well, these things should potentially go on hold. So obviously, you know, we are increasingly aware of the carbon footprint that all of us have, and I think this was incredibly interesting to highlight sort of the various aspects, some of which, you know, I have not thought about before, and I'm sure you haven't either. And I say that, you know, the broader you, all of the tens of listeners to this podcast. But there's the implant side of things, there's the distance travel for patients and from the provider side, the use of physical therapy, the use of general anesthesia, sterilization, and then conferences. Orthopedics, according to they have a cited work here, our annual conference has nearly the highest attendance of any medical specialty, millions of miles of travel. So these are all things that they want to highlight for us and that they are encouraging us as a field to be stewards of. And they have a number of suggestions, many of which, you know, either intuitively make sense and you may have been aware of, but maybe not. The amount of waste generated by the healthcare industry as a whole is 4 billion pounds, which is just incredible. And, you know, that's not all orthopedics, of course, but especially with the increase in robotics and navigation and things like that, the disposables are just exponentially increasing in the OR. And that's not something that they really get into here, but it's just my added commentary and something additional to think about. So some of the examples in the OR, switching to reusable gowns, minimizing biohazardous waste, reducing instrumentation in trays, and then reusing or reprocessing certain equipment such as tourniquets, X-fixes, staplers. I'm not sure exactly how that would work, but then, you know, they suggest using fewer trays, fewer implants, minimal custom packs whenever possible and appropriate. Use gel pads rather than single use yellow foam, which I think probably when you consider the manufacturing, transportation, and disposal, probably does add a lot to the waste. Physical therapy, they really, you know, you'd think that the physical therapists are putting our cases on hold here because they target physical therapy for dramatic slashing New Year's prices, going crazy. The utility of physical therapy for common conditions treated, they really want you to consider how useful physical therapy is for that. And they want to emphasize home programs with video or pamphlet supplementation. So they actually want you to just kind of cut down on physical therapy quite a bit. And then consider conference and course attendance that encourages remote formats across all orthopedic organizations. This is all great, and everyone can say, yes, we need to do this, we need to do this. And, you know, for me, this was the area where it really stood out. For others, it may be, you know, you're like, wait a minute. Hold on a second. It's like that old NFL commercial with the kid and Cam Newton where he was like, you know, maybe I can grow up and be a football player like you one day. And Cam's like, yeah, sure. He's like, if I work really hard and practice. And Cam was like, absolutely. And he's like, and then I could take over your starting job and you'd be my backup. And he was like, whoa, wait a minute. And he's like, yeah. And then I'll be your mom's favorite player. And he's like, what? It's like that. It's like, yeah, we got to sign on. And then they're like, yeah, but you can only use like this one implant. And it's like, well, wait a minute. What do you mean? I don't get my special tray. But this is really where it stood out because one, you know, I don't know how physical therapy is going to feel about, we have to cut you completely out of the picture here. I don't know how patients are going to feel about, here, just do this video or this pamphlet. That really doesn't work for everybody. And various different organizations, being on the board of directors of the North American Spine Society, the organizations are incredibly invested in getting people to the conferences. Will not work in terms of a financial backing and a foundational backing. Industry in particular, if you're doing the conferences remotely. And we know from generally the conferences that did do remote 2020 and 2021 experience, those were not high quality experiences for the the attendees and for those who are, if it's, we just went all remote, then you should just get your CME from doing JBJS clinical classroom and the self-assessment exams, which you should do anyway, but there's no reason to attend conferences if it's just a Zoom meeting, in my opinion. That takes everything out. So saying this is, I think, a little bit tone deaf and somewhat myopic, and I would put that on hold, because I think, when does the tipping point start? There's a tipping point for everybody where you start saying, well, yes, I want to help, and yes, but I don't want to help that way. And I think, you know, organizationally, you're going to lose everybody if you're like, and we just need to do away with conferences altogether. I don't think that's a non-starter.
Won't happen, won't work, won't be implemented. So, you know, exactly right. We do the same thing in modifiable risk factors for patients, right? Some you can actually modify and make a change in, other ones are just not going to be able to easy to change. And so my take home from all these type of articles, which are good, it opens our eyes to the carbon footprint that we're causing and the waste that we're doing. So what are tackleable topics that we can do? And one of the things that we've done in our OR, which has been great, you've seen, is that we've reduced the amount of hazardous waste, which is great, right? Because biohazard waste takes 10 times as much to process than regular waste. So you don't need to throw everything into the red bags, right? And I think the history of thinking is like, well, there's a little bit of blood you have to throw into a red bag, right? That's not necessarily the case. So those things have totally changed. And we were throwing like implant boxes into red bags. I mean, everything went into a red bag because it was in the operating room. It was considered a biohazard and it had some sort of exposure to the environment. And that's not the way it should be. So that was one change that happened where they made a smaller bin and placed it outside that was a red bin. And that reduced our hazardous red bag hazardous waste by a lot. So that was something that was implementable and useful. Same thing with, instead of like single use, use, you know, multi-use gel foams and pads and things like that. So to your point, I completely agree with you. Some things will be implementable and we should be cognizant of this in what we're doing, but it also says bike and walk to work. And if I do that, I will be walking for hours to get to work. So I love the idea of it.
I didn't even highlight that part. Let's talk about where they target anesthesia. So they want to minimize the use of inhaled anesthetic agents and then consider neuraxial, regional, and local anesthesia modalities whenever possible, which is virtually never in spine. And when I was a resident on other services, we used to call the neuraxial, regional, and local anesthesia team the stealth team, where stealth was an acronym for slowly touch everything, add like 2 hours to the case. Because you'd be like, yeah, they're like, oh, we're going to do regional anesthesia with a block. They come with the ultrasound, they're looking, they get a different ultrasound. You know, I think they're just trying to like get to the point where you would say, you know what, we just have to cancel this. It seems like it's not feasible. It's like they're looking, and then they're like, oh, I don't know, we might need to get another device. So, you know, they want you to do these things. Again, this potentially adds time. It takes long enough for our anesthesia teams in the preoperative area. Other people may move more efficiently, but
stealth. I love it. Can't wait. Yeah. To use
slowly
that,
touch everything. Some of the other things, though, conserve water when scrubbing. I think that's like an easy, absolute, like everyone can do that. Transition to 100% waterless scrub and implement programs throughout the hospital for that. I think that's also a very viable option. And then minimizing instrument use, because instrument processing is a water-intensive process, which some of us don't necessarily, even if we're intuitively aware of how it's done, we're not seeing it. So it's not seen, not thought about.
Completely agree. Out of sight, out of mind. Same thing with like CPD. We don't do the sterile wrappings of the trays, and we see them all coming off and throwing those all away. So that is another one that's tackleable, right? We can put into reusable containers. So just like we had the whole recycling movement come forward and reusable bags now, and then they're going to start charging for bags, right? That they have in a lot of different areas. That might happen across the board.
Start charging for trays.
Charging for trays. If you want that special tray with your special stuff in it, if you want Cam to say, okay, you get your tray, then you better make sure that happens. So keeps it good, but stay environmentally friendly as much as possible.
Absolutely.
All right. Wrapping it up with honorable mentions. We're going with reference axes for tibial component rotation and total knee arthroplasty, computed tomography-based study of 1,351 TBA by Jang et al. There is a commentary on that one.
Got to get that last one in there.
I did have to get that one, and it's TBA, which I love saying. Hip displacement after triradiate cartilage closure in non-ambulatory cerebral palsy, who needs continued radiographic surveillance? By Asma et al., 30 days free. current complications of cast removal with oscillating saws and a novel method for reducing such complications, a comparative clinical study for those who do casting all the time. Sevenkan et al. With a commentary attached to that as well. Establishment of a novel rat model of gram-negative periprosthetic joint infection using cementless hip hemiarthroplasty by Ibrahim et al. Assessment of regional functional effects of surgical treatment in thoracic insufficiency syndrome via dynamic magnetic resonance imaging by Tong et al. And finally, sonicate fluid cellularity predicted by transcriptomic deconvolution differentiates infectious from non-infectious arthroplasty failure by Fisher et al. So ending it on a wonderful basic science note, thank you for joining us again in the wonderful month of January. And we're looking forward to kicking off 2023 with all of you.
And remember, everyone, it's a new year, but your case is still on hold.
Enjoy.